Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, we are pleased to be joined by James Bridger to close out our series on African navies. As a reminder, you are our best advertiser. Don't forget to tell a friend about our podcast available on iTunes and Xbox Music. We think it's a fine product and hope you do too. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Once again, I am your host, Matt Hipple, director of the Next War blog, and I'm here with James Bridger, one of our writers. Has written on Africa and the Middle East before us before. He is a maritime security consultant with Dalek System, and his focus is on piracy and asymmetric maritime security issues in Africa and the Middle East. Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me.
Would you rather me call you James or Jim, just to start out?
Oh, actually, Jim is what people in America tend to always gravitate to, so
All right, let's go
with that.
We'll go with Jim. Okay, perfect. All right, so you mentioned earlier today before we set this up that you had seen Captain Phillips, so because I figured it would be better for the podcast, I went out and I watched it. Tell me what you thought.
Well, I'll be honest. When I saw the trailers, you know, a few months ago in this coming up, I thought it was going to be something of a cheesy, sort of heroic, fictionalized account of things. But yeah, went and saw it on last Saturday and was very impressed. I think it's, you know, probably the best movie I've seen this year. I mean, the acting from Tom Hanks and the Somali actor who plays Musi, the pirate leader who had no previous acting experience, who was cast out of Minneapolis.
That guy was from Minneapolis?
Well, yeah, it's a funny story, actually, because, I mean, the last sort of big movie in Somalia was Black Hawk Down, and they took a lot of flack because they just used random African-American actors who really, you know, Somalis look fairly distinct from that. So they went and did open casting calls in Minneapolis and Toronto, where there's the large Somali diasporas, and that's where they pulled all the extras and actors from.
Okay, that's cool. He is from the diaspora, because I thought, really, Tom Hanks is great, but Tom Hanks was just Tom Hanks in this movie. I figure, like, okay, Tom Hanks in every movie. But the pirates were awesome. Those guys were no-shit pirates.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I really, really liked it. And I think they captured, you know, I'd read the reviews before that were saying, oh, you know, they missed the context of, you know, how did piracy start? You know, this thing was just, it seems like they're just randomly floating around in the ocean as this ship goes out. But I actually think it played quite well. You know, I don't want to, I mean, people generally know what transpired.
Yeah. It's like the Titanic. You know, yeah, it's spoilers. No, dude, everyone knows what happened at the Titanic.
You know, the movie opens with Captain Phillips heading off to fly to Oman for this voyage from Oman to Kenya, and he's talking to his wife about, you know, the troubles economically, how the world's just going to be a bit harder for their children, lack of opportunity. And then immediately that's juxtaposed with all these Somali teenagers running down to the beach, hoping that they're going to be able to take part in, you know, risking their lives sailing off into the sea in these tiny boats. And then there's you know, two parts I really like that as these sort of pirates start attacking, you get the crew talking about the crew of the Maersk Alabama saying, you know, we're not the Navy, you know, we're not being paid enough to fight pirates with hoses. And at the same time, you have these very young bottom rank pirates who know they've gotten themselves into a pretty horrible situation when they're floating around in a lifeboat with Captain Phillips and, you know, two naval destroyers and an aircraft carrier trailing them. But they can't go back empty handed. And there's that line about, oh, you know, we both have bosses.
Yeah.
And so you get these two sides of, you know, this incredibly globalized world of maritime commerce where, you know, it's a lot of people making money at the top and a lot of people really toiling away at the bottom.
You know what this movie reminded me of? I thought it was a modern-day version of Tora, Tora, Tora. Maybe not on the grand scale that Tora, Tora, Tora is, but it really was, you saw the Japanese side, you saw the American side, and what's the modern-day threat today? Yeah, we talk about Al-Qaeda, but it is, in a lot of these cases, especially in Africa, it's that vacuum of instability that all these things happen in. And I was like, this really does remind, that beginning scene reminded me of Tora, 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 when it shows the two different sides and it juxtaposed themselves. Did you have a particular, what's something you thought in the movie? Because there's a whole bunch of stuff in there I thought that was particularly accurate. I love the fact that everyone was wearing coveralls and white t-shirts on the Navy ship, which I really miss because I saw Battleship and that was all the blueberries that everyone hates. But what was something that you thought that was particularly accurate or particularly poignant in the movie?
There was two things I liked. One was, again, going back to this idea of, you know, we all have bosses, and I said I'm working on a couple articles now about these sort of Somali pirate lords who finance and organize this from the top down, and there's this guy, Garrod, who is never seen, but they keep mentioning him. And, you know, that was just a little detail that, you know, meant something to me, and I don't know who else might have cared about that, but, the second piece, too, I mean, one, you know, little complaint, I thought, you know, Moosey, the lead part, of course, his English was not going to be that good, and that he's able to get jokes and read in English, and obviously that's for dramatic effect, but one piece of dialogue that actually came out of Captain Phillips' book is when they first board and get onto the bridge, and they say, you know, don't worry, we're not Al-Qaeda, just business.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was directly lifted from what happened, and... you know, you had all these sort of fears in and around 2007, 8, 9, when Somali piracy kind of exploded, that it was, oh, you're going to have this nexus of terrorists, Al-Shabaab or what have you, and pirates, and hijacking ships to blow them up and run them aground. And really what transpired is none of that happened because, you know, people will pay money to whoever they have to get by, but this is purely a business operation and a sort of rationally minded calculation of profit and opportunity.
You know what? That's a really good point. As I noticed that it's just business, line two, and in a very sort of macabre third world way, I noticed the shit always rolls downhill from the beginning. So everyone's hanging out in this village. They're just relaxing, and then the big boss comes up, and he's shooting. He's yelling at everybody. Then he turns to the guys who are the sub bosses, and then they're yelling at their guys, shooting and getting mad at people. And then the larger gentleman, I can't remember the pirates by name, but the big guy, you know, he's getting pissed under the stress, and he's turning it on the little kid. So you see that shit rolls downhill. But something that I noticed that I'm very glad they did. It was very textbook. It was, you saw the pirate triggers, you saw the ladder, you saw the extra fuel, you saw the motherships, you saw the small boats. They put all of that operation into context so that the people watching the movie, it was very clear how this happened, why it was operated in that way. I thought of particular interest was when the mothership was out there and they had the equipment on board to fix those skiffs. I'm like, this is really good stuff. It is a dramatic movie, obviously, but for the people who don't know and don't read, this is showing them line by line how operators overseas look at, this is how I tell if someone's a pirate.
It's perfect, you're right, and I noticed that exact detail when they're sitting out, like, you know, they've got water, they've got gas, they've got, you know, all these things that, and they actually, I know a couple people who consulted on the film from the piracy angle, and, you know, they definitely took their detail too. But, the other thing I liked, of this is it shows both sides, this asymmetrical angle, that first you have this tiny, only at the end, a single skiff going after this massive container ship, and then later, you know, two destroyers and an aircraft carrier going after a lifeboat with four pirates
right
on it. And I watched the movie with my girlfriend who, you know, had not been studying Somali piracy for the last 5 years or so. And when she saw the little skiff go out to make its return attack on the Maersk Alabama, she was saying, you know, how the hell are they going to take that ship? Like, how is that even possible?
And, right.
You know, that's what everyone thought back then too. I remember looking at, you know, some of those early huge hijackings, the MV Faina, the Cirrus Star. It was without the lack of armed guards, I guess, is what really is allowed it to happen, that all you are really doing is spraying fire and getting a ladder up.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal, I think, had an article today, I believe, that was called Arming Captain Phillips, which was about armaments, and a lot of people don't realize the difficulty of international law, where you can't just pull in and out of port with weapons. You have to throw them into the ocean. I think for a short period of time, I know the UN recently, the IMO, but they brought up the issue where they wanted to legalize port ships coming in and out of port with weapons. But for the longest time, even private security had to bring them on board while they were underway and then chuck them off before they got to port.
Well, it's the floating armories that have sort of solved, which I guess is perhaps too soft a word, that problem, where you get ships just sort of loaded with weapons that sit pretty much near the mouth of the Red Sea and then also sort of off the coast of Sri Lanka or further south into the Indian Ocean, hugging the African coast, where you're able just to embark and disembark guards and weapons as a way of not throwing them overboard. But then there is going to be this problem, and it's one that's a huge concern for India in particular, that, you know, the private maritime security industry is starting to regulate itself better, but it's never going to be a perfect world, and one day, you know, piracy will have reached the point where armed guards are no longer necessary. And suddenly we don't even know, 30, 40,000 weapons that are just floating around on the Indian Ocean, where are those going to end up on these, you know, floating on these ships with these companies? You know, some very, very legitimate above board London, US based companies. And then, you know, you also have the sort of race to the bottom of far sketchier ones that, I mean, you see it in the news. You can look it up on YouTube of, this kind of cowboy style outfit.
I did like the fact, and I'll tell you this, I read your article, Searching for a Somali Coast Guard, which I think is a good segue before expanding and talking about the West, but immediately when he came on board and he said, or not when he was on board, when he was on the radio and he said, this is the Somali Coast Guard, I thought of your quote.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing. I mean, the story, you kind of get, separating the myth and the rhetoric and the self-justification from reality is a bit difficult, but I mean, everyone looking at this knows the story that, you know, you did have sort of the complete collapse of the Somali state in 1991. You did have foreign fishing fleets, Asian European fleets moving in and, illegally and very harmfully fishing, you know, primarily tuna and lobster out of Somali waters. You had sort of mafia-linked groups dumping toxic and biomedical waste there. And then sort of around the mid-90s, two things sprung up. One is you had random warlords across Somalia who would provide armed guards to these foreign fleets, fishing fleets allowed them to do that. And then you also had private security companies that went into Puntland in particular in an effort to train a coast guard to, you know, they would finance themselves through the sale of fishing licenses and, you know, they would put a stop to primarily illegal fishing and then also sort of piracy had just started around that time. But then for various reasons, in Puntland in particular, all these private security companies had to pull out for one reason or another. There was, you know, internal civil wars or there was contracts that had been too closely linked to one president and one clan, and there was a shift of power, the contract fell apart. So you did have a lot of people who were actually trained as coast guards, and then suddenly their wage disappears, right. And, you know, they're left with a boat, a gun, and, you know, skills of
that happens a
maritime.
Lot. Yeah, it happens a lot where you arm a large group of people, and then suddenly you stop paying them. I think the Congo, this happens with Mobutu back in the 60s. Suddenly the military stops getting paid, and the guy's like, huh, I'm not being paid. I'm in charge of this pile of guys with guns. And then everything that you'd put together to stop insecurity from happening sort of falls all apart. You know what? Let me segue real quick, since we're talking about Somalia, and I want to sort of slowly edge our way out of the East. Is real quick, if you can, back in May, you wrote us an article about PMPF, the Puntland Maritime Police Force, and then you got into foreign policy, right? And you had the Wild West, it was Wild West in East Africa?
Yeah.
Tell me about PMPF. So we're talking about the conventional sort of U.S. militaries there. A lot of people have heard about the attempts to get the transitional federal government. Talk about these private efforts.
Okay, well, the PMPF is a very controversial effort, but one that I've, you know, I spent a lot of time researching and found very fascinating is, you know, you have had these top-down efforts for the last 20 years, the people pouring money into Somalia and it disappears, and people say, oh, I need, you know, $50 million to build a Coast Guard, and nothing ever happens. And then you had in 2010 in Puntland, sort of the autonomous federal state of northeast Somalia where piracy had really been concentrated, you had a new president come to power who, you know, depending on you who you ask, was either very serious about getting rid of piracy or realized that there was actually more money in counter-piracy than there was in taking a cut of ransom spoils. And he went around looking for the usual donor money to find to build a Coast Guard or a Marine police force and was unsuccessful in that. And then you had it was Eric Prince of sort of Blackwater infamy who was living in the UAE by this time, and he had sort of had recently been reading up on the U.S. and the Barbary Wars and the Marines going into Tripoli and that, and was, you know, convinced that you cannot eradicate piracy unless you do it on land and take out the infrastructure on land. So you had this system developed where you had a South African private military company. And when I say private military company, I don't mean what, you know, you had in Afghanistan or Iraq of just sort of armed guards or logistical staff. I mean, this was, you know, a lot of the same people from Executive Outcomes, which was the
the guys in Sierra Leone and Angola.
Yeah, you know, they were yeah, you know, they're a conventional army in the sense of they had an airline, they had air support, intelligence, tanks, you know, what have you. So these ex guys, and they came in and you know, are a very effective group. You know, there was about less than 100 trainers that went in, mostly South African and then other Southern African, Angolans, Namibians, you know, who have a long history of both training African armies and operating in these conditions themselves. So, you know, they went into a place where the EU is not going to go to train people. NATO is not going to go to train people.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was financially backed by the United Arab Emirates, who obviously as a sort of oil exporting maritime state had a pretty vested interest in reducing piracy. And this group, they came into Somalia, they began training, they began procuring vessels and equipment, and quite soon thereafter they came under fire from the UN monitoring group that is in charge of sort of monitoring the arms embargo that's been on Somalia since 1992. And under that embargo, anything. You can't do any training. You can't provide a uniform. You can't provide flak jackets, anything without making an appeal and getting it approved by the Security Council, which was not done at the time. And so this program was shut down. They rebranded the security company. It was started up again. It had a good 6-month run where they were very effective. They trained about 500 Marines led by these mentors from, you know, mostly from South Africa, and they just basically went around the Puntland coast from village to village, chasing out pirates, negotiating with local elders and establishing a small presence that just stopped pirates from being able to use these sanctuaries to resupply, to hold vessels, hijacked vessels at anchor. And, you know, in my opinion, and if you look at sort of the data of when piracy really declined in Puntland versus when they were operational, it had a big effect. You know, they freed that ship, the Iceberg, Christmas Eve last year. You know, it was the only indigenous sort of mounted operation that freed these mariners who had been hostage for almost 3 years. So, you know, were they an effective force? Certainly. But again, you did have this problem of a lack of oversight, the sort of fear of the UN that this was going to become entrenched as sort of a private militia is looking like it's coming to pass that way. They've gone sort of underground in terms of it used to be very well publicized. They used to have a Washington law firm lobbying for them and doing publicity that was sort of well done, and that's all been shut down. The company itself has left, and you've now just got about 15 or 12 South Africans left flying helicopters and doing technical work for them, and they've been involved in fighting Al-Shabaab in Puntland somewhat, but more or less just on the low now.
So are you saying the firm itself is going underground in Puntland, or are you saying that they've sort of dissolved a little bit, like their mission is complete, or they've been integrated into the Puntland as part of an official? Like, what would you say their status is? Like, where is it?
Well, the private security firm itself, it was rebranded as Sterling Corporate Services and registered in Dubai, and it's dissolved. The UAE at one point in June of last year pulled funding temporarily. So without funding, the company itself dissolved and pulled out. About a dozen people expats stayed behind under the direct pay of the Puntland government. The UAE later started kicking money back in. And they're very well armed. I mean, they have the only indigenous air support of any force in Somalia. Outside of the African Union forces, they're probably the best armed,
really
well-trained government force. Yeah, they have a fleet of armed technicals. They have these French Alouette helicopters, sort of reconnaissance helicopters, have been re-rigged with belt-fed machine guns that they've used. They have a fleet of RIBs that they've used to sort of interdict ships that have been illegally fishing or dumping waste. So it's an effective force, but the problem now is just what do you do with it? And I've spoken to people from the EU training mission who, we don't want to get ahead of any political situation in Somalia, but yes, we recognize they're effective. Even the UN itself has come around now and said, yeah, this is an effective force. We just need to find a way to integrate it into some sort of Somali-wide security structure, but the issue is no one knows what that'll look like, and
if it'll exist at all. You look at that and you look at Somalia, what's left, and then you look at Puntland and Somaliland, and you're like, are these people ever really gonna get, and what's their interest as well? Mm-hmm. If Puntland and Somaliland have been managing their own affairs legitimately or illegitimately, what's their interest? They don't really have an interest in joining the rest of Somalia, because what'll it be, a reconstruction campaign using their funds? And I don't see why they would do that.
Yeah, and that's what I wrote about for SIMSEC last week, was Somaliland too, which is sort of self-declared independent state. They've had their own Coast Guard, which again was trained by a Norwegian private security company. And again, very effective. They increased port revenues. They got it ISPS certified, the Port of Berbera. They basically... piracy never took root in Somaliland because it was sort of rooted out before it could ever, establish itself.
I feel like that's a location too where they can't really, if you're sitting right next to the IRTC, which is so heavily patrolled, you're probably, and maybe this is just me, but once they tap down, and it's kind of a small place, it's not exactly somewhere where you can easily conduct piracy operations.
But then, I mean, you have to ask yourself the blow up of piracy in 2007, 2008 was all in the Gulf of Aden, which was, before there was an IRTC, but it didn't come from Somaliland. It came from Puntland, which is, a further bend around the coast.
Just the thought being is that it started there, but it's also a place where it's a lot easier to control. But, you know better than I do.
But getting back to that question of, why aren't we seeing a Somali Coast Guard? And, I wrote about, there's been so many, about five or six different schemes where some French, American, Kenyan private security company comes, and whatever the government happens to be in Mogadishu, they sign a deal for, $50 million. We're going to build a Coast Guard. We're going to interdict illegal ships. We're going to train these people. But then nothing ever comes to pass because there's no money and there's no agreement to do it. And there's no piracy really anywhere near Mogadishu. So.
Right.
We've recently had another one of these schemes. It's a Dutch company that I tried to dig up on. It's very hard to find any past performance from them. Atlantic Marine and Offshore Group, I believe they're called. And as soon as that announcement was made, both Puntland and Somaliland were saying, no, you're not going to infringe on our sovereignty. We're doing just fine. Thanks. If you're going to have any sort of maritime security regime for the country as a whole, and even the most optimistic outlook, I think it'll be a very decentralized, loose federal structure with each of these regions controlling their own forces and, inshallah, some sort of cooperation between them or information sharing. But the idea that you're going to rebuild a Coast Guard that's going to stretch from Berbera to Kismayo is a pipe dream.
Let's jump over to the other coast. Let's talk about the West. You've written extensively on West Africa. I really liked your article re-examining the Gulf of Guinea fewer attacks, better pirates, because it did. It is very different, and I kind of had a challenge, not a challenge, but a question. It's not a challenge at all. A question for you: will piracy in the Gulf of Guinea be a bigger challenge, specifically because the shipping is coming in and out of Nigeria? They have the intelligence infrastructure, which you mentioned, to grab all this info. You just have to sit, wait, watch the path of the ship, and you already know where to pounce. Is that going to be our problem, where it's going to be so much harder to control piracy in the Gulf of Guinea? I'm sorry, you wanted to mention the IMB report as well, and we jumped right over it. So if you could talk to that as well.
Well, no, you're right. It plays right into it. It's what we've seen over the last, since 2011, is Somali piracy has declined and declined, whereas, now I'm hesitant to say, there was a lot of misreporting that piracy in the Gulf of Guinea or Nigeria was increasing. It wasn't really in terms of absolute numbers, which are very difficult to come by anyway. There's a huge amount of underreporting. But it's a very different game, and sort of, I mean, it's centered on Nigeria, obviously a massive oil exporter, but then also lacks the capacity to refine its own oil. So you have sort of an unnaturally high level of regional tanker trade where oil's exported from Nigeria. It's refined in Gabon or Cote d'Ivoire and then brought back to Nigeria and sold for a subsidy. So it's already, it had bred this huge black market for stolen and subsidized oil.
Now, can you speak to why that's the case? I mean, they make so much money off of oil. Why wouldn't they create an in-house organic ability to refine it?
That's a question there isn't a great answer for. Basically, corruption is the root of the problem for a lot of things in Nigeria, piracy in particular, oil theft in particular, that, you know, you have, and it's difficult to get sort of from open source or, you know, local contacts, really accurate information on who's exactly doing what, but we know there's high-level politicians, regional governors, traditional chiefs, local oil execs who have been using pirates, militants, oil thieves for their own purposes for quite some time. So there's a very, very large vested interest in keeping the system the way it is because people are making a lot of money, not in a way that's beneficial to the country as a whole, but to the cliques that are involved in it. But what's happened in Nigeria is, and why piracy didn't exactly just increase out of nowhere, is sort of the mid to late 2000s, you had this socio-political economic insurgency in the Niger Delta where you had various minority ethnic groups that quite rightly felt that they were being shafted by Abuja and not given their share of these, you know, these massive revenues that are being sucked out of their backyard while polluting their backyard. And they started attacking pipelines, attacking government forces, taking foreign oil workers hostage, all these things. And part of it was to make a political statement to force a concession, but then they also realized, you know, there's money to be made here. Kidnap and ransom, oil theft, etc. But then there was an amnesty in Nigeria in 2009 where the government basically bought off the top tier of all these militants just with cash payouts and also, somewhat ironically, security contracts for them to protect the pipelines and maritime space that they'd previously been pilfering. But, you know, you had all these people at the bottom, these, you know, the same huge influx of unemployed young men who, you know, see all this wealth being sucked up around them and have no way to get at it. But it was only in late 2010 when you saw a new form of piracy arise, which was to hijack an oil tanker as it was waiting at anchorage or in a ship-to-ship transfer off the coast, which there's plenty of them because, you know, the ports are backlogged. There's all this traffic, as I mentioned. So, you know, you hijack a tanker, put the crew down in holding, you turn off AIS, you turn off any communication, you'll go as far as repainting numbers, what have you, and then you make the ship disappear for a couple of days, and you bring a smaller vessel, you unload all the oil, and then that's been prearranged to sell somewhere else on the black market, and then you release the ship. And what's interesting about this is it's actually a far more profitable business model than Somali piracy, where, you know, you have to go out floating in the middle of the ocean, hoping that you're lucky enough to find a good ship, hope that you're able to overpower it, and then you have to bring it back and hold it for ransom for, you know, who knows, 6 months, a year, 2 years, hoping that you're going to get a ransom that's going to make all this time worthwhile. Where in Nigeria, it's intelligence driven. I mean, part of it is there's a lot of publicly available information about what ships are carrying what and leaving where, when. And then also, as I mentioned, this sort of corruption in the oil industry and the political system that also facilitates this, that, you know, ship X is going to be leaving, Lagos at this time. We're doing a ship transfer there. You, by the time you've hijacked it, your boss has already arranged who you're going to sell the oil to. And, you know, a fully laden vessel full of, and it's often refined product they go after, and you can flip that for sort of $3 to $5 million. So you're making $3 to $5 million in about 5 days. As opposed to Somali piracy where, you know, similar, you get a ransom of $5 million perhaps, but it would take you 9 months, a year plus to get.
Right, and maybe this is the case, and I'm sort of triangulating this from what you're saying, is maybe a big part of the problem too, the Somali model is possibly easier for Somalia, specifically because the infrastructure and corruption and the corrupted state infrastructure exists. It would be easier to sell material if you just leave Somalia and show up in a port and say, hey, what's up? I have this oil tanker. They're going to go, who the hell are you? Whereas perhaps in Nigeria, I mean, they brought up the case, I know, on the internal discussions at SimSec, we've been talking about the pirating of vessels. I think they're not pirated so much as they're just straight stolen. Like, you contract it, you give some fake papers, and you drive off with it and just never show up again. And the government, I think Nigeria came out with a new law that says it's holding companies that don't verify paperwork responsible for the black market activities or whatever those ships end up doing.
Yeah, I mean, you have this massive, because of this, the Nigerian oil is exported for a refinery, then brought back in and sold at a subsidy. You've had this black market system of oil theft and resale for a long time. And that's what drives piracy as well. That in, you know, in Somalia is really the only country in the world where you can take a ship and just go and anchor it offshore and hold it for a year without anyone really doing anything about it. You know, Nigeria, and then of course Nigerian piracy is spread to the waters of, you know, Benin, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, Gabon in the south this year. You know, those are weak states with a really low sort of maritime security capacity, but they're not failed, but it's, you know, the corruption that really enables it. And you've now got these, you know, you've had Nigerian organized crime networks, basically as long as, that predate Nigeria existing as a country, that have become more international now that, you know, they have spotters and contacts in these other regional countries that will provide them information about ships leaving there, that if, you know, it's like sitting on a balloon, you can try and protect the waters of Nigeria, and then piracy spreads to Benin, then you protect the waters of Benin, it spreads to Togo. And then there's all these allegations of sort of Lebanese or Russian Eastern European criminal interests that facilitate this black market oil sale. You know, working off open source stuff, I can't really tell you much more about that, but,
right.
You know, it's a very profitable enterprise that's really a product of that environment.
Now, to get sort of, let's push inland a little bit with Nigeria specifically, because it is important, to the issue of these, offshore threats. Something that I'd read in one of the articles you'd written was piracy in West Africa preventing a Somalization of the Gulf of Guinea. You mentioned, and this brought up something that I remembered back from college, is the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. How close do you think, give me sort of a rundown if you can, on them, and based on their name alone, I'm still getting back into my Nigeria study. Is that getting anywhere near or close to something like they had the Nigerian Civil War and the Biafran separatist movement? Because it seems like they say the Niger Delta, but that's pretty much Biafra that they're talking about. So is there any connectivity between those two? And if Boko Haram really starts kicking it in Nigeria, is that something that might become an issue with more separatism spreading throughout the country?
I really don't think there's a large separatist movement with MEND, the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, and there were some other similar groups. They're often based around the, you know, it was the minorities within their own minority state. And it's always been about just getting their share of oil concessions rather than outright separatism. But it's also always been about making money too. You know, you can't separate the sort of the political from the criminal, from the economic. They're all interrelated. I don't think you're going to see that as any sort of separatist threat. And in relation to Boko Haram, there's not really any connection between the two. They're very distinct, very different motives. But, I mean, the problem is that the Nigerian military has to sort of fight a war on two fronts.
Exactly.
Is why I think, you know, both are able, have been able to have the gains they've made and cause the trouble they do because, you know, neither one can be sort of focused on at any one time.
Well, for the particular case, and I know back in 2009, this was on information dissemination, and kind of inspired or reminded me to do this update that we did on SIMSEC, is that Nigerian military's, or the Nigerian Navy's last major update was in the late 70s, early 80s, when it came to any sort of equipment. So now they're looking at this increased boom threat, from all this oil bunkering that they've let get on top of them. Meanwhile, now you have Boko Haram in the north, and now you've got to split that investment. And it's a real mess. Let's sort of segue into this. We talked, since we're talking about inland rebellions, it's kind of Sierra Leone, Liberia. We have a long history of that going on, in West Africa. Private security in West Africa, if you can talk to that, is that still, alive and well? I mean, Executive Outcomes, we talked about them already. They have a rich and rather successful history when it comes to Liberia. And Sierra Leone, yeah. and Angola, is that still something that's on the forefront? Obviously, it's not as loud and proud as it was in the past, but
well, interestingly, the sort of the two things, and I perhaps should have mentioned this earlier. The reason why sort of West Africa is so different is, you know, two things that really brought that suppressed piracy in the off the Horn of Africa were foreign naval patrols and the ubiquitousness of armed guards. The reason that those two things don't work and don't exist in West Africa is the piracy is almost all, I mean, it's not even technically piracy under the UN definition. It's
right.
Taking place in territorial waters. So you're not going to have none of these, Nigeria in particular, is not going to allow foreign warships encroaching. And also they don't allow private armed guards for, you know, the reason, you know, we mentioned this case of India, they don't want a bunch of ships with a bunch of foreign armed guards floating around that they know nothing about, that, you know, that they know nothing about where these weapons come from, where they're going to go. So you're allowed to, in Nigeria and other countries in the region, you can basically rent out naval personnel from those countries to protect your commercial vessel. But that creates its own problem, that you have cases of them just being sort of horribly trained where they're, you know, jumping overboard. And pirates will, you know, they're not deterred by people firing at them sort of the same way they are off the Horn of Africa. Like, they'll put up a fight and local armed guards have been known just to jump over. Or you get, you know, people who will guard your ship by day, their shift ends, and suddenly that's the moment you come and get attacked. And, is that a coincidence? Not at all.
You know the term sobels, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of that term. That came out of Sierra Leone, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of soldiers by day, rebels by night. I've heard anecdotal evidence of people still wearing their Navy uniforms and all they do is pull off insignias and ranks. they don't even get changed. Interesting. It's a really side note, but, this old Sierra Leone Executive Outcomes connection. So piracy of the oil theft scale isn't an issue really as you get up the coast to Sierra Leone. But illegal fishing is a huge problem. You know, large Asian fishing fleets that have come and, you know, these post-Civil War countries simply don't have the capacity to do it themselves. But there's quite a few entrepreneurial people, a lot of them from Executive Outcomes, who stayed in Sierra Leone after the contract ended and now make their living doing, sort of maritime domain awareness contracts and preventing illegal fishing. So you do have remnants of that, and you do have foreign private security companies doing that in Sierra Leone, Liberia, but there's no foreign private security in sort of the Gulf of Guinea proper, except for Benin now has signed a deal with an American private maritime security company, Advanfort, that it hasn't got off the ground yet, but apparently they're going to provide sort of a full package maritime security deal for them, both their waters and at the port as well. But, you know, we got to see how that plays out.
Speaking of Benin, now I read this, and this might only just be coming off the runway here, but ECOWAS, I think, just signed a deal to set up an MCC, Maritime Coordination Center in Benin.
I believe it's gonna be in Cameroon.
Okay.
Although they've toyed around with where they're gonna put it. I mean, the idea is it should be in Nigeria. That's the root of the problem. But it's also Nigeria's the source of the problem. It's this corruption that, you know, if you just had a maritime security information sharing center and those same people working there are the ones feeding information to various criminal groups, it would fall apart. I mean, you also have this problem that, you know, it's sort of French, West African countries surrounding English Nigeria and some distrust there. So the center is going to go in Cameroon is the latest plan. And I wrote about this a few months ago. They've tried to mirror it on the Djibouti Code of Conduct, which has had some success right. in regional information sharing and training, around the Horn of Africa, which itself was based on RECAP, which is a counter-piracy organization for Southeast Asia based out of Singapore. Again, it's a good plan on paper. Information sharing is incredibly important. As I mentioned, there is none. I mean, right. probably 60%+ of pirate attacks go unreported. And you even have cases of, there was a case in Togo a few months ago where a vessel was attacked. They were able to fend it off. They reported it to Togolese authority, and the captain was arrested because he was just accused of colluding based on no real evidence whatsoever. So you don't have uniform or even well-respected reporting procedures. You don't have information sharing. You have joint patrols between Benin and Nigeria, but, I mean, look on a map and see how small Benin is, and, you know, take a look at Jane's and see what the Benue Navy consists of, and, you know, it's a Nigerian effort. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and the regional approach is good because that will sort of roll back this spread of this crime that emanates from Nigeria. But at the end of the day, this is, you know, a Nigerian problem, and there's sort of the international community writ large and right. even the sort of West African community. There's much less that they can bring to bear to address the cause of this problem, even than there was with piracy emanating out of Somalia.
Well, because that piracy, like we talked to before, was, I guess we'll just call it less wily. It was much more obvious. I'm reading this report. I just went to look it up, which explains. I was talking to somebody at NAVAF, and I mentioned this MCC at Benin, and they said, "Oh, you mean that thing in Cameroon?" I guess on October 9th, ECOWAS came out, and their committee of the Chiefs of Defense Staff came out and announced that Benin would be the host. So I don't know if they changed their mind.
Oh.
But I actually wanted to speak to that. Maybe you could tell me, because from back in the day when I was able to really deep dive into this stuff, it seemed, especially with ECOWAS, that the big issue for Nigeria is it didn't want the other kids playing the game to think that they had all the toys, so that they would sort of try to build it. So like when Sierra Leone happened in Liberia, it was mostly Nigerians, but they didn't want to look as this is Nigerian, for lack of a better word, imperialism, because they're always sensitive to that topic, is they want it to look. I mean, that I'm just going to throw out my two cents. I would imagine that they wouldn't put it in Nigeria because they, again, don't want ECOWAS to look like a Nigerian-dominated tool where they're just using other countries to deal with their problems. Because it is technically yeah. everybody's problem, but still, you don't want to look like the guy who's gaining all the advantage and power at the same time.
No, certainly, and I mean, that's a factor that yeah, they don't want to be seen as dominating it. There is the sort of Francophone, Anglophone divide. It was never, but yeah, I'll have to follow up on the moving it to Benin, which actually makes a bit of sense. But the actual idea for a center has been bounced around between Ghana, Benin, Cameroon, Gabon. You know, when I actually see something up and running, that's when I'll, you know, take a real interest of, okay, we've got a permanent location. But as long as it's just talk, it's always going to be subject to... I mean, I think the reason it was announced in Cameroon is they had the conference in Cameroon, and the president made it his sort of, you know, that was his push or piece of work to contribute. And, you know, it'll bring in money to whoever hosts it. You know, you'll see the EU and the US and who else ever probably financing it the same way they have with the previous efforts in Southeast Asia and East Africa.
Now, is Cam... Maybe this is just me. I didn't know that Cameroon was in ECOWAS.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe so.
Huh.
Or ECOWAS... Or is it... Well, I mean, even actually, they may be in... And the acronym has escaped me, but there's the sort of Central African version.
Oh, okay.
Of ECOWAS. And that declaration, that maritime conference and this idea was between both organizations, ECOWAS and...
So it's that's me, then. It's larger than I was doing with my research. Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. Now, all right. Let's move a little bit more inshore then. Boko Haram. Have you done studies on that? Or are you mostly in the maritime arena?
I certainly dabble in it and try and keep up. I haven't really written on Boko Haram in a couple of years now. But I mean, sort of African security writ large is general interest of mine.
Then let's go with the writ large topic. Sort of that we All started right. off the week with, I'm not trying to self-advertise here, but my article with was Al-Shabaab is only the beginning. Your assessment, you're looking at these maritime security issues in Nigeria, not directly related with the Boko Haram issue, but writ large Africa. You look at the scope. We kind of had that map. And the map showed the different countries being attacked or issues politically. And you see kind of a one contiguous from Mali to Nigeria, Niger, Libya, Egypt, Sudan, all the way to Somalia. What are we looking at with convergence? Is convergence an issue that we need to worry about where we have these disparate groups, some associated with Al-Qaeda, some not, where, we have all these maritime security issues, but we're going to have an even bigger problem on the land? Or where do you see this going?
There is some convergence, but not quite as much as people want to see. And I mean, I'll preface this. I'm Canadian and have been in DC for the last year. And there seems to be, you know, in order to get attention for your pet issue as an African security specialist, in order to get in front of Congress, people really want there to be this convergence between Boko Haram, AQIM, Al-Shabaab, and, you know, everything else in between. And there is at a sort of, you know, there's communication between them. There is some flow of training and logistical experience, but they're not really linked up groups working towards any sort of common goal. They all remain, I mean, the Shabaab is, you have sort of a nationalist and a more international jihadist factions within it that sort of ebb and flow for control within the organization. Boko Haram is very nationalist focused. I mean, AQIM obviously linked more into the global jihadist network. And, you know, there's collusion where it's convenient, but I do think this sort of, that there's this huge nexus being built is a bit of an overblown threat. And, you know, you do have all this empty space. I mean, you have trouble in East Africa. You have trouble in West Africa. Obviously, militias going around in the middle in the Democratic Republic of Congo that are not really part of that whole scene at all. And then you have all this sort of uncontested space in the middle in Sudan, Chad, Niger, southern Libya, southern Algeria. So, you know, do various criminal and extremist groups interact? Yes, but, you know, it's not this mounting giant singular threat of convergence that I think is overblown a bit.
Well, okay, that's fair. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. My entire article was about that, but I guess, you know, you're looking for that thing that you have to fight against. You're like, that's pretty threatening, that's pretty threatening, that's pretty... Oh, they're all sitting next to one another. What happens if they all got up and decided to shake hands? Now, kind of your view, writ large, militaries, corruption. Talk to maybe how corrupt... You can go with specific cases in each country, but when you talk about these countries, when you talk about their navies, I know the Nigerian army, especially their police, I think their police are just considered the most corrupt organization in the country. How are they, can you speak to that maybe, how these maritime groups, we hear about the armies, but you really don't hear about the corruption level or maybe the lack thereof of their navies and how successful that's going to be or how it's going to change?
Well, that's actually the thing you don't hear about them is, for the large part, they don't exist. African states have, you know, since independence, put full primacy on the army at the expense of Navy and Air Force. And then even, you know, in the army, you get cases where the army and its leadership were largely gutted and kept toothless to sort of keep the threat of a coup down. Mm-hmm. So, like you said, with Nigeria, you have navies that... you know, equipment from the 70s or earlier, and even if they look, you know, even remotely impressive on paper, you know, I've seen figures of Nigeria that only, you know, 30% of vessels are operational at any given time. So, and I mean, that was the case. If you look at, I mean, even Somalia used to have quite an impressive navy when they were sort of courted by the Russians and the Americans during the Cold War, but that was left to rot. That was sold off. That's a similar story. Elsewhere. So maritime security capacity is actually a fairly novel concept in Africa, and it's really piracy that kicked it off and got attention. So you do have, you know, money coming in. You have the U.S. donating these Coast Guard cutters to Nigeria. I think there's...
The NNS Thunder, the ex-USCG case. Yeah, they actually just went to Australia, which I thought was very cool, especially since the South Africans didn't go. And you have this, I think I cannot speak to whether or not, no, that's right. Their, Anduli, I can't remember their other, ship of the line that they have, but that also, I think, went to an International Fleet Week once, but, I was shocked to see that. That was very impressive.
Yeah, that was the one thing I thought was impressive. And then two, I was like, man, don't they have more pressing issues? Like, is it really a good idea to sail away right now?
Go ahead.
No, that's correct. So you have money, you know, I mean, the U.S. does its Africa partnership training stations, but again, that's sort of a couple of exercises a year. The EU starting a program in West Africa. China is donating or giving loans for a lot of vessels now in West. I mean, that's the thing, is the sort of energy security in Africa is going to become more of a Chinese problem than it is an American or European problem.
Is that associated with their offshore patrol vehicles? Because I was surprised at how cheap. They said $45 million for two Hilo-capable offshore patrol vehicles. So is that kind of part of their scheme? Was a loan agreement part of that?
I'm not sure. That was in Nigeria?
Yeah, Nigeria.
Okay. I know China basically bought Benin a new coastal, I mean, more of a coast guard than, I mean, it's called a navy, but, you know, to your understanding, the coast guard. So they're getting it from, I mean, actually Brazil's gotten involved. I mean, when you think about actually how much closer Brazil is to West Africa than North America is, and, you know, you have the Portuguese connection between Brazil and Angola and Equatorial Guinea and stuff. They're getting involved in training and a bit of procurement. So it's developing now, and it's, you know, is corruption going to remain a problem? Certainly, you know, pipelining and jockeying for influence, is the level of cooperation between the Army, Navy, Air Force, maritime, whatever maritime safety agency you happen to have, ideal? No, it's not. Everyone's, you know, very defensive of their powers and responsibilities, but you know, there's things to be optimistic about. On the other side, you have sort of South Africa and Mozambique and Tanzania have gotten together to do their own patrols of the Mozambique Channel, and you know, you did see piracy spreading down there at one point, and now that's completely stopped. I mean, the thing is, looking forward to the future, as, you know, you're going to get, you have these offshore fields off of Ghana, Liberia, further up the coast in the Gulf of Guinea, and then also off of Kenya and Tanzania. So, you know, more oil is going to bring more money, but more problems and more people trying to make a quick buck off of that oil. So,
yeah. You know what? It's a huge mess. The one thing that I kind of wanted to touch back on, and I don't think people realize, is they look at a lot of African militaries and they're like, well, what's going wrong here? Is I don't think people realize that balance between defending your state and defending against a palace coup. I think Mobutu was particularly famous for this. Sierra Leone's second civil war, I think, was due to this, because the government was building militias to provide local protection. The army and the rebels, I think, rejoining as part of the deal, the army didn't like that, got together, and then launched a coup instead of a rebellion that time. So I think when Western observers look at these militaries, they have to realize, because of the level of corruption, both in the state, because if you have people in the military that look at corruption in the state as treason, or corruption in the military as an opportunity of gaining the advantages of the state, you really have the danger of they just don't have the tradition that we have that speaks against this. Go ahead.
No, you're right. I mean, this idea of protecting the state is not well ingrained. They're very young states, you know, even state identity in a place like Nigeria that's basically, you know, being torn in half, if not more parts. And I mean, in West Africa, you know, you've had military coups in every single country except for Senegal, multiple coups in some countries. So, you know, the army is a way to make money, and not even a lot of money at that at all, at a salary, but it presents an opportunity for graft and corruption and shakedowns and whatnot. But
yeah, I did read and go ahead.
But yeah, this sort of military professionalism, as you can't, to someone who's never been to West Africa or elsewhere, it's very easy to sort of jot down plans on paper about, oh, you know, these are the vessels they need, these are the radar stations they need, this, but then, you know, in practice, it's a very different thing.
So we talked a little bit about South Africa. Your thoughts, South Africa versus Nigeria. Who's the powerhouse? Nigeria is the one involved everywhere. They don't have the navy. They don't have the tech or the stability of South Africa. But South Africa, at least to me, from the obsessed casual observer, seems to be a lot more hands-off, and maybe it's not integrated into what's going on in the continent.
Yeah, I mean, South Africa have, you know, what exactly their role as something of a, you know, continental power hegemon has always been up for grabs. I mean, even you had the incident of them having peacekeepers in the Central African Republic who got killed in that coup earlier this year, and then suddenly they were pulled back, and their navy was left to rot from, you know, it was a very capable military during apartheid years. Obviously, they were fighting wars basically the entire time. A large part of that was dismantled in the post-apartheid era. You know, a large part of that had been left, the Navy in particular, had been left to decay. There's, you know, they'll send peacekeepers to various missions, and, you know, it's impressive what they've got going on in terms of cooperative agreements with Mozambique in terms of naval patrols and that. But both Nigeria and South Africa lack the capacity in terms of certain things to project any kind of power outside of their immediate neighborhood. I mean, you had Nigeria, even Nigeria and Sierra Leone, that was, you know, they didn't have their own transport aircraft to do this. And you actually had, you know, executive outcomes did a better job in Sierra Leone than the ECOWAS peacekeepers did.
Very true.
So these are all things that they're developing slowly, but certainly on the right course. And it's not for anyone to, again, jump in with a solution that's been drawn up in Washington or London. These, you know, these ideas of building sort of readiness forces in Southern Africa, in West Africa, North Africa, East Africa, Central Africa. I mean, things look bad when you check the Africa section of the BBC, but, you know, an amazing amount of progress has been made if you think back to the, you know, mid-90s, early 2000s, that sort of post-Cold War period where just these really nihilistic civil wars popped up everywhere. You know, the progress that's been made in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, in Angola, you know, in terms of our Africa Navy Week, it's still an optimistic future.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's what I liked. That was my favorite part about Africa Navy's Week, is that it doesn't get a lot of attention, but even though it's bad, because no one's going to say it's good, is that none of the articles are really like, hey, we're screwed. It's always like, here's a bunch of challenges, people are corrupt, there's pirates, there's Al-Qaeda running around the place, there's militants everywhere. But you don't see that nihilism of the past where it's sort of like, I've just sort of consigned myself, I know this is going to be a mess, is there is that forward progress, and that's pretty awesome. I ask this of everybody who comes on the show. Your opinion doesn't have to be a threat to the United States or, in your case, to Canada. Greatest global security threat that you see?
Oh, man. Well, you know, as someone who's been largely furloughed for the last few weeks, I would say the greatest threat is American dysfunction. Perhaps. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the long-term effects of American political and financial dysfunction that'll soon show themselves elsewhere around the globe. I said that very quickly. I'm obviously a little bit bitter.
I will take that. I'm going to take that as a subtle way of a Canadian saying that he is really worried America doesn't remain the global hegemon. And I tell you what, I appreciate that so very much.
And I'm even, you know, growing up, you get a, you know, a fair bit of anti-Americanism. Oh, no one wants the U.S. as the world's policeman. You know, that was growing up in Canada and elsewhere. But, you know, it's by far the least bad alternative to either a sort of vacuum for power or a situation where Russia and China are able to quite easily block.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
American Western designs, or, you know, we've, again, going back, things still may look bad, but, you know, this has still been the most peaceful half century the world's ever seen.
Pax Americana, yeah. what got you into studying African security, actually? Because I wanted to ask one of my favorite books, and I'm wondering if maybe it's kind of what you got you into it, is Shake Hands with the Devil by General Dallaire, and that blew me away. I love that book. That's one of my favorite books about Africa. It really, that and A.J. Venter's War Dogs really sort of got me into it, and I was wondering what got you into African security issues.
I mean, yeah, Shake Hands with the Devil is, I mean, you know, Romeo Dallaire is a compatriot of mine. I saw him speak when I was in high school. And that's actually, but it goes a bit deeper. My dad's family's South African and then sort of emigrated their way out around the Commonwealth. So it's always had a bit of a draw. I worked in South Africa for a while after university, and it's always had something of a draw, but, it actually, the thing that got me involved in maritime security and African security was, the explosion of Somali piracy and how absolutely bizarre it seemed. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on it in 2008 and 2009, and just like I said about Captain Phillips and, you know, the casual observer, how the hell can this happen? How can a skiff of people who don't even have sandals on take over a, you know, football-sized oil tanker with $100 million worth of cargo on it? And the fact that that was able to happen is what really led me down this road that I'm on now.
You know what? I'm glad you said that, because actually I thought it was, if you take it out of the context of the movie, because, you know, Captain Phillips does all this stuff, and you know what? I won't say it. It's a spoiler. Never mind. I think it's a cool observation, but I don't want to ruin it for people. Is there anything that you want to plug? Your Twitter handle is @maritime_Jim. That's correct?
That's it. I'll have next week. I've got articles coming out with Risk Intelligence and Foreign Policy looking at these pirate lords, what's happened, what pirate infrastructure remains. This case of, we didn't get to it, but Afwene, this guy who was arrested in Belgium this weekend.
You want to get to it? It's my podcast, so we can stop closing out and go into it if you want.
We'll have to. We'll get that in print for SimSec later.
Yeah,
I still got to work on it, but it's a very interesting story there, and
don't forget, look into that U.S. Marine who became a Somali warlord. I think that's one of the crazy
U.S. Marine.
He is a real human being. I don't have the article open with his name on it, but maybe I'll write something about him just because he's not maritime so much, but he was a Marine, which kind of makes it a maritime issue, but it's a wild story. You can be found at The Risky Shift, Foreign Policy, SimSec, your Twitter handle is @maritime_Jim, spelled just like maritime and Jim are normally spelled. Do you have anything that you want to plug?
Atlantic Council of Canada.
Right,
that was my entry into this. You can find them. That's they've changed it. NATO in Canada, I believe. Atlantic Council of Canada, just search that. They have their own maritime nation program that's a lot of excellent stuff. A lot of really good young writers there. We've already plugged SimSec,
and
I'm sure.
If you go to the SimSec Next War blog, you can find the link for Atlantic Council of Canada maritime issue under our partners if you want to click that. Anything else you got?
You know, I'll plug Delex Systems here. If you're interested in anything I've had to say, they're providing support and services for some very interesting maritime security analysis, risk assessment work, and, you know, have been generous enough to allow me the freedom to pursue what would otherwise be fairly arcane interests.
Did you meet Tim Walton?
I think
in your office. Yeah, he was on podcast number 2, I think. Yeah, he was on podcast number 2. All right, and if you want to find SimSec on Twitter, that is @SimSec, spelled C-I-M-S-E-C, and you can find us at www.simsec.org, spelled the exact same way. If you would like to write an article, please email me at nextwar, @simsec.org. Again, same spelling, and please, if you would, we do not have advertisers, and it would be really nice if you went around and told people to listen to this podcast if you're listening right now. So you can find me at America Hipple, that is my last name, with the word America in front of it. You can find me, of course, at SimSec. Thank you so much, Jim. This has been a pleasure.
All right, well, thank you, Matt.